Ladies and gentlemen, I know that for many of you, part of the motive that has drawn you to these lectures has been your desire to learn how to apply the philosophy of Atlas Shrugged to your own life. Some of you have described the sensation while reading Atlas of being transported into another universe, of experiencing a new perspective, a different sense of life, a different sense of what was possible, but you often complained that you were unable to keep this sense of life, that you lost it when you returned to the everyday reality of your ordinary concerns, that it became like a dream or a distant longing, or worse, was forgotten for months at a time. And we asked, why did this happen? What could one do to maintain the Atlas Shrugged sense of life? How could one keep that perspective alive, and how could one implement it so that it would be more than an abstract dream? In different ways, that is the question that I have been answering during these past 19 weeks by giving you the intellectual foundation of the Atlas Shrugged sense of life. But there is one aspect of the problem still to be discussed, and that is contained in the title of this, the final lecture, Why Many Human Beings Repress and Drive Underground, Not the Worst Within Them, but the Best. Repression is commonly understood to mean the excluding from conscious awareness of immoral thoughts or desires, the excluding from conscious awareness of the irrational, the undesirable, the evil within one. When one thinks of repression, one usually thinks of it as pertaining to the bad, not to the good, to the blocking off or repressing of vices, not virtues, to the closing of one's mind against the worst within one, not the best. But what I shall demonstrate tonight is that many people do, in fact, repress their noblest and highest, and that this is one of the great causes of man's tragedy and suffering. The concept of repression was not originated by him, but it is, of course, Sigmund Freud who has done most to make men aware of it, because of the crucial and central role which repression plays in Freud's system. Freud conceived of repression as the mechanism by means of which man conceals from himself and drives into the underground of his unconscious the instinctual impulses and desires which are forbidden as evil by the moral beliefs of society. According to Freud's own particular mythology, this meant that man represses his inevitable desire to make love to his mother and to murder his father, that man represses his secret homosexual inclinations, which everyone allegedly shares to a greater or lesser extent, that man represses his basic impulses to torture, plunder, brutalize, and engage in cannibalistic practices. This was Freud's concept of man's deepest desires, the desires inherent in man's nature, residing in the so-called id. And while many have rejected this interpretation of man's nature, they still associate repression primarily with the repression of depravity. Freud believed that repression is a psychological necessity of mental health, that man must repress in order to avoid neurosis or psychosis. It is sometimes believed that Freudians are against repression, but this is not true. They are against unsuccessful repression, that is, repression that fails and allows forbidden thoughts, sometimes in distorted forms, enter into consciousness, thus causing guilt, fear, and a variety of neurotic disturbances. Their concept of a totally healthy individual is one who has been fully successful in repression, fully successful in concealing from himself, in burying the nature of his own deepest desires. Because Freudians believe that man's desires proceed from his instincts, not from his mind or premises, and because they believe many of those desires to be irrational and immoral, the only hope they can project for man is that he will be able to evade identifying these desires, that he will be able to satisfy them in disguised, sublimated, and socially acceptable ways and never have to face the truth about what he really is after. Never have to know, for instance, that his love is based on a secret hate, his kindness is based on a secret fear, his ambition is based on a secret lust to destroy. Unfortunately, many psychologists who have properly rejected Freud's instinct theory, as well as much of his concept of what it is that man represses, have nevertheless accepted his premise that repression is psychologically necessary and desirable, that, to some extent, it is a precondition of mental health. What is repression? Repression is a subconscious activity which seeks to keep some ideas, thoughts, feelings, memories out of conscious awareness, to inactivate them, to forbid them entry into consciousness, to remind you of some points which I made about the psychology of repression in Lecture 2, in my discussion at that time of the subconscious. To repress is to establish a mental block that forbids a thought entry into consciousness and into the tool of consciousness, namely language. If, in the value system the mind has formed, there is the explicit or implicit premise that that which the mind finds painful or which clashes with its self-esteem is not to be perceived, then the subconscious, functioning as an obedient instrument, takes the order literally. No such forbidden thoughts are allowed into consciousness. Such repression, once instigated, continues to operate automatically and subconsciously. Forbidden ideas will not be verbalized, forbidden desires will not be recognized, forbidden emotions will not be identified. They will continue to exist in the subconscious and to influence behavior. A is A, facts are objective and not to be wiped out by self-made blindness, but they will be given no acknowledgement. The man whose self-esteem, for instance, in part depends on being above any feelings of envy, may thus not know that envy is what he feels for his more competent rival. He will have a dozen sensible explanations to account for his antagonism and hatred, or he will go out of his way to praise that rival. The woman whose religious beliefs forbid it may not perceive that she desires her best friend's husband. She will not know why she avoids him, nor why she is irritated by her own husband's every action. The compulsive woman chaser may literally not remember the name of the one woman who spurned him. A professional humanitarian may never allow into words the knowledge that what he feels at the sight of those who suffer and depend on him is a sense of pleasure and power. The son who sacrifices the career he wanted for the sake of his mother who opposed it may never identify that what he now feels toward her is the desire to kill. When they develop neurotic symptoms, those who repress may cry that they are the helpless victims of their malevolent subconscious. But the truth is that the subconscious does not have a will of its own. It has no secret diabolical purposes. It is a machine run by the premises it is fed. And if men feed it contradictions, evasions, and self-destroying injunctions, they pay a psychological price calculated by the most ruthlessly logical of computers. Repression is the establishment of a standing order, in effect, that certain facts, ideas, or feelings are not to be perceived or integrated. Mental health does not require of man total omniscience concerning the contents and operation of his subconscious. It does not require of man a full and total memory of every event and experience his consciousness has ever registered, nor of every association and conclusion his consciousness has ever formed. But it does require the absence, on the conscious and subconscious level, of any premise forbidding knowledge. It requires of man that he place no value above consciousness, no value above awareness, which means, of course, no value above reality. It requires that, as he grows older, man learn to translate into language the subverbal conclusions of his childhood and test them against reality in the light of his adult understanding. And it requires of man that, when he acts, his actions never clash with his conscious convictions. It is not in the nature of man that his subconscious should be to him what Freud has made it, namely an object of dread. But if man seeks to bury in his subconscious the reality he refuses to face, then it is not his subconscious, but reality that becomes its own avenger. Ignorance is not bliss, not in any realm or aspect of man's life, and least of all with regard to knowledge of his own psychology. Man is fallible, he is capable of drawing mistaken conclusions and of feeling desires that proceed from irrational premises, but because man is a being of volitional consciousness, he has the possibility of correcting those premises, of revising his thinking or non-thinking, and thereby of correcting his emotions and desires. Now, in understanding this concept of repression, it is very essential to distinguish it from a process with which it is sometimes confused, namely suppression. Repression amounts to self-deception and is undesirable. But there are many instances in which suppression is fully both desirable and necessary. Suppression, in contradistinction to repression, is both conscious and directly volitional. It consists of the deliberate switching of one's focus from one line of thought or area to another. That is, to push aside some consideration because it's imperative that one look elsewhere or concern oneself with some other consideration. For instance, suppose you are having an argument with someone and find that you are growing angry. You decide to suppress the emotion. That is, you do not pretend to yourself that you are not angry. You do not repress, but you do not give vent to your anger. You do not let it consume you. You turn your mind to the task of clarifying the disagreement. You focus only on that, and you consciously and volitionally ignore what you feel in order to think more clearly and efficiently. There are obviously many instances in which suppression such as this is both desirable and necessary. Let me contrast repression with suppression in the following way. Suppose that before coming here tonight, you had a conversation with a friend who says or does something that deeply hurt you. Now suppose you had concluded in the past that a truly independent person can never be hurt by anyone. Suppose you had internally resolved never to be hurt by anyone, no matter what. You had made your invulnerability to being hurt a matter of your self-esteem. This would be a perfect formula for repression. You would not feel when you arrived here, "I'm hurt, but I won't think about it now. I'll concentrate on a lecture and consider the other issue later." No, instead you would feel, "Hurt? No, I'm not hurt. Why should I be hurt?" You may be vaguely conscious of a numb sensation in your chest, of an odd sense of disconcerting heaviness, that you will not identify its meaning or source, there will be a violent resistance against the words that would name your actual state. That state, which you do not identify, is the product of the collision of two thoughts within your subconscious. I'm hurt, and I must never be hurt. Now, if you merely suppressed your hurt instead of repressing it, you would possess a full knowledge of your actual emotional condition. You would openly acknowledge to yourself that you feel badly, but you would decide that, for the purpose of grasping a lecture, you will temporarily deflect your focus from your pain and think about it later. Now, the practical difference is this. A painful or disturbing emotional state that is admitted and identified can, if the state is unwarranted, be corrected or resolved. One can do whatever is necessary in order to deal with it. But an emotional response one does not permit oneself to experience or to face is like pressure building up to an explosion that frequently results in neurotic symptoms. As I have stated in a previous context, premises will out. They cannot be negated by self-made blindness. They can only, if repressed, leave one the more helplessly at their mercy. Unfortunately, repression is encouraged by the prevalent belief that to feel certain emotions is the irredeemable proof of one's evil. In fact, it is not a man's irrational emotions that constitute the proof of his evil, but the fact that he acts on them against the judgment of his mind. Emotions as such are involuntary. They are the automatic summation of one's premises. Man can make mistakes in his premises, and he can experience emotions which he knows to be inappropriate or irrational. His moral stature will be a function of what he then proceeds to do about them. If he struggles to understand and correct them, he is not evil, even though he may have been in the past. But if he acts on the premise that his emotions are blindly to be followed, if he abdicates his reason, that is what makes him immoral. But when, for instance, the Bible tells man that if in his heart he lusts after his neighbor's wife, that is the same as actually committing adultery with her, what can a man do if he accepts this? It fuels the desire, except frantically repress the desire and blind himself to its existence, lest he be forced to damn himself as evil. How many people indefinitely perpetuate irrational emotions of hate, fear, jealousy, and rage by repressing them, by never daring to identify what they feel, and thus cement their mistaken premises into their soul. Just as it is an error to regard one's irrational emotions as the irredeemable proof of one's evil, so it is equally an error to regard one's rational emotions as the infallible proof of one's virtue. It is true that rational emotions are the product of rational premises, which are the product of rational thinking, and can thus be taken as an indirect sign of past virtue. But if one merely contemplates one's ideals, feels love, reverence, inspiration, but never does any further thinking about those ideals or about how they are to be achieved in reality, if one does not live by them, one is not a man of virtue, one is a traitor, regardless of the nobility, in quotes, of one's feelings or aspirations. There is only one rational basis of self-esteem and only one rational standard of virtue, namely the act of thinking, the dedication of one's mind to the perception of reality, the commitment of one's consciousness to an absolute acceptance of reason. Let a man tie his self-esteem not to the act of thinking, but to the things he feels or doesn't feel. Let him take as the standard of his fitness for reality the content of his emotions, and he has opened the door to repression, to the blocking out of any emotion or desire that conflicts with his concept of what one is properly supposed to feel. It's appropriate here to remember Francisco's statement to Reardon: there are no evil thoughts except one, the refusal to think. Now, what of those who seek to repress not their vices, but their virtues? How can a man reach the state of believing that the best within him is a threat to his self-esteem, a threat to his fitness for existence? That is the question to which I shall now turn. I shall begin by asking you to think back to the earliest days of your childhood. Every child and every adult needs the conviction that he is living in an intelligible universe, that the world around him and the people in it are such that his consciousness can grasp and deal with them. Every child starts out by expecting rationality, consistency, and intelligibility from the human beings he encounters. He desires to understand and to be understood. He does not begin with the malevolent conviction that life is chaos, that nothing makes sense, that irrationality, inconsistency, and injustice are all he can hope to expect. He begins, and you began, with the assumption and expectation of a benevolent universe, by which I mean a universe in which happiness and fulfillment, not misery and frustration, will be one's natural state, of a world in which the people one encounters will be honest, open, direct, and rational. I do not mean, of course, that such an attitude and expectation is conscious or conceptualized in a child's mind, but only that such is the implicit expectation of a healthy consciousness at the start of its life. How many of you expect it now? The question is, what happened in the years between? What happened to that sense of life? If today someone were to act irrationally or unjustly toward you, if they were suddenly to act in a manner drastically contradictory to what you had been led to expect, many of you would shrug in tired, numb resignation and feel, in effect, that's life. You'd probably reproach yourself if you had felt any degree of shock. Today you are not on the premise of expecting rationality or consistency. And when I say expecting it, I do not mean this merely in the statistical sense, I mean it in the metaphysical sense. I mean that most of you have come to accept irrationality not merely as the statistically average or predominant, but, for all practical purposes, as the metaphysically normal, as the necessary and inevitable in human nature. Now, of course, there are irrationalists, such as James Taggart, who dread rationality or justice and who want to think of men as depraved. These are persons who, early in life, willfully and deliberately chose evil as their own mode of existence. But it's not of them that I am speaking. I am speaking, to paraphrase Galt, of man the victim, not man the killer. That is, of those who, at least predominantly, carry within them the submerged desire for a rationality which they have given up seeking or expecting to find in those they meet. The steps by which an individual gives it up begin in childhood. First, with the irrationalities of his parents, the contradictions, the broken promises, the arbitrary, unexplained injunctions, the incomprehensible punishments, and the incomprehensible rewards. Then, with the aunt or uncle, perhaps, who started out by being so kind and understanding, but who, out of a bad mood, slapped the child's face one day and shouted at him angrily for no reason within the child's power to understand. Then, with the playmate, who suddenly and unexpectedly smashed his favorite toy out of sheer spite because the playmate's mother would not buy him one like it. Then, with the teacher, who made unwarranted and sarcastic criticisms of him in class in order to vent her own neurotic frustration and hostility, while the other students looked on and laughed in order to stay on the good side of the teacher. Then, with the girl who deserted him for a boy of whom she had previously spoken with contempt. Then, with his first employer on his first part-time job, who gave him switching and mutually irreconcilable orders and would blame anyone around him but never admit that he, the employer, had made a mistake. All of these experiences, or their equivalents, adding up through childhood and adolescence to the unstated feeling that any rational understanding, communication, or closeness with other human beings is impossible, and that one is childish or naive or unrealistic or a sucker to count on or expect it. This, in principle, is the basic pattern by which a child can give up not only his expectation of encountering rationality, but of achieving any intimate value affinity, any value closeness with those around him. From his first passion, perhaps, for the heroes of childhood stories, which neither his parents nor playmates shared, cared about, or understood, to his observation that the things that interested others he found meaningless and boring, to his dismay when a friend he had found at last, who seemed to share his values, criticized him one day for not being a regular fellow like the rest of the kids, to the girls who admired him for his independence but preferred more conventional boys for dates, to the companions who claimed to like him but who were bored by or resented those qualities of which he felt most proud. All of these experiences, or their equivalents, adding up to a feeling of helplessness in human relationships, to a sense of estrangement and isolation and metaphysical loneliness. If one could communicate such concepts to a child of five, and if one were to tell him that he would reach the day when he would claim to be indifferent to human rationality, the day when he would claim that nothing hurt or disappointed him in relation to other people, since he did not expect anything good from anyone, the day when he would lose the knowledge of what it was he had wanted from people and pass by in resigned indifference those who might have had it to offer, the day when, if he found something great, he would be too embarrassed to express the admiration it deserved for fear of being rebuffed, the day when he would no longer be able to believe in the reality of that greatness, even when he found it, the day when he would feel guilt and self-reproachful over any flicker within him that still wanted it, that still wanted life to be dramatic, exciting, romantic, important, the day when he would freeze and discourage others who wanted it, as others long ago had frozen and discouraged him, the child would not believe it. He would protest that he will never reach such a day. But you know how many children do reach it, as you know in what manner most of you have reached it. You ever wondered why you were unaccountably touched, almost to the point of pain, when someone showed an unexpected kindness toward you? Have you ever wondered why you sometimes wanted to cry, not at a sight that is ugly, but at a sight that is beautiful? Not at music that is tragic, but at music that is irresistibly gay. Not in a moment of suffering, but in a moment of happiness. Have you ever wondered why you find it so painfully difficult to speak of the things that matter most to you, even with those who are closest and most trusted? Have you ever wondered why you sometimes felt ashamed at your own uncharacteristic expression of some deeply intense and serious emotion, and felt compelled to make a joke at your own expense in the next moment? Have you ever wondered why you sat passively while values you despised were being praised, and values you respected were being attacked, and you remain silent and unprotesting, not necessarily or exclusively out of fear, but also out of a heavy, weighted feeling amounting to the words, "What's the use?" The name we have given to the premise that makes this possible, the premise that leads men to submerge the best within them, is the malevolent universe premise. The malevolent universe premise is the belief, usually held only in the form of an emotion or generalized feeling, that the good, that is, that which one most deeply values and desires, has no chance on earth, that there is no way to achieve one's deepest values among other men. That premise is normally experienced as a sense of life. It has the feeling of a metaphysical conviction, of a fundamental view of one's relationship to existence. Usually, this premise is formed by a process of emotional generalization, by moving from the observation that many men are irrational to the desperate feeling that, for no reason one can understand, men will inevitably be irrational. Not all of those who hold this premise would identify it consciously. Perhaps the majority would not. Many would actively deny that they hold it, but it is nonetheless the unstated implication of much of their behavior. While such a premise as a metaphysical conviction is mistaken because it amounts, in effect, to a damnation of human nature as such, I do not have to point out why even the best among men could be tempted to such an error. One of my purposes in these lectures has been to provide you with philosophical and psychological ammunition against the malevolent universe premise. One's values and goals are determined by one's view of existence, by one's view of what is possible. To the extent that one succumbs to the malevolent universe premise, one will necessarily feel that one's deepest values are unachievable, that for all practical purposes they are metaphysically inappropriate, inappropriate to life on earth. And to the extent that one cannot give up those values, one will feel oneself to be, in effect, a metaphysical freak. This premise, residing in the subconscious, will drive one to institute a process of inhibition and repression, to throttle the responses and desires that one feels to be unrealistic and impractical. And the tragic irony is this: one will be driven to it in self-protection, in protection of one's self-esteem, in the name of one's desire to be competent to deal effectively with the facts of reality.